Thank you all for coming. As you can tell from your programs, this is a program of music related to Lincoln. I've divided it into three parts that I hope complement each other well. As I looked through repertoire, it became clear to me that there was a fairly consistent reception of Lincoln through the ages musically, so I thought it would be nice to portray that. So our first set is music from after his death, what we might call art songs, songs for piano and voice, in the sort of late romantic style. The second set are pieces from around his time, either related to him or responding to his death, more popular tunes. And the last set are a selection of three pieces from a larger collection of songs written by actually a Cornell alum named Joseph Gregorio. And I'll tell you about the texts for those songs as they arrive. But you have in front of you the texts to all of the pieces. And just a note about the first three, two of them are settings of Whitman, Whitman poems that some of you may know. Whitman wrote an extended poem known as Lincoln's Burial Hymn. And if you know it, the first three lines are, when lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed and great stars early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned and yet shall mourn with ever-returning spring. And the selection from that burial hymn, this is the last song that we'll do in this first set, is from the central passage of the Whitman poem. Stanford, who was a British composer, set the entire lengthy text for actually chorus and various vocal soloists and orchestra. So this is one portion of that larger piece called Elegiac Ode, which he himself also arranged for piano and soloist. And the other two on this first set, I couldn't find much out about Robert Brain, but it's a nice piece, and I hope you enjoy it. And Will Earhart was actually mainly a music educator based in Pittsburgh and composed a little bit. So in fact, the Whitman poems, the Whitman settings are the first and third selections that you'll hear just now.
Captain, rise up and and hear the bells. Rise up, for you the flag is flung, for you the bugle trills, for you bouquets and ribbon wreaths, for you the shores a crowding, for you they call the swaying mass, their eager faces turning. Oh, Captain, dear father, this arm I push beneath you. It is some dream that on the dock you fall in cold and dead. My captain does not answer, his lips are pale and still. My father does not hear my arm, he has no pulse or will. But the ship is anchored safe, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip, the victor ship comes in with object won. Exalt, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I, with silent tread, walk the spot my captain lies, fallen, cold, and dead. What's in your eyes, hollow and sunken, and deep as the skies? The figure of sorrow, silent and lone, listening for God in the heart of a moan. Abraham Lincoln, whose was the art that touched you with humor, though broken of heart? Infinite tenderness furrowed a face, saw humanity's tears to laughter give place. Abraham Lincoln, what is your thought of the woes of a world that injustice has wrought? Though the blood of the prophets of freedom be spilled, the thunders of Sinai cannot be stilled. Abraham Lincoln, what says your soul? Whose gesture heroic spans history's scroll? Let the feet of devotion with glory be shod, earth's martyrs keep step with the strides of a god. Abraham Lincoln, why are you sad when all of love's world would be smiling and glad? The ages are pallid with deeds of the wrong, and brotherhood cries, and the night is so long. Abraham Lincoln, how came your power? of setting fate's clock to the stroke of time's hour. In the quiet of prayer was the world set apart, the better to hear the tick of God's heart. Abraham Lincoln, immortal of fame, will righteousness rule in democracy's name? When the nations strike, hands and in love are made one, the shackles will fall, and my work will be done. Thank you.
my pleasure now to introduce someone local who many of you may already know, a history professor here, Margaret Washington, who has recently come out with a book on Sojourner Truth and is a well-respected expert on slavery and women's issues in slavery and life at that surrounding Lincoln. So it's very appropriate that she was willing to come here and speak about Lincoln's relationship with the abolitionists. And so I'm very happy to introduce to you Margaret Washington.
Abraham Lincoln said that he was naturally anti-slavery. Yet he repeatedly insisted, "I am not an abolitionist." What was this label that our so-called great emancipator strove to separate himself from? An abolitionist advocated immediate and unconditional emancipation. An abolitionist believed that slavery should end even at the price of union. In fact, radical abolitionists who followed William Lloyd Garrison embraced the motto, "No union with slaveholders," and called the Constitution a covenant with death and a compact with hell. An abolitionist advocated equality without distinction of race, creed, or color. It would seem that Lincoln did not fill this bill. Lincoln was a unionist. Indeed, asserted Walt Whitman, the only thing like passion or infatuation in the man was the passion for the union of these states. This was an obsession that Whitman, a Jacksonian Democrat and sometimes public Southern sympathizer, shared. Both anti-slavery men disliked abolitionists, upheld white supremacy, advocated black colonization to Africa, and while excoriating the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, insisted that every self-emancipated person be returned because that was the law. All of these shared philosophies bound the working man's poet, whose first leaves of grass nodded to black humanity, and the Kentucky-born commoner and prairie lawyer who believed that one should not eat their bread by the sweat of someone else's brow. Lincoln and Whitman's contradictions, to borrow the poet's own words, were multitudinous. In Washington, where Whitman did hospital work during the Civil War, the two men saw each other in passing many times, sometimes nodded toward each other, and yet they never met. Speaking at his first inaugural address, Lincoln immediately clarified his position on abolition for any doubters, and there were many outside of the movement. He would uphold the Constitution as a compact of states that could not be broken. But he supported the 13th Amendment to the Constitution passed by Congress that would forever guarantee slavery in the states from federal intervention. His position notwithstanding, Lincoln deeply felt the influence of abolitionists. They quickened their activist pace for the first two years of the war. They castigated him in the press, spoke against him from the platform, and took advantage of his open-door policy to appeal to him personally. Republicans, in their zeal to create a victorious coalition, had even appealed to radical abolitionists for the first time in years and got them to vote for Lincoln. Lincoln was also feeling the heat from a cultural perspective. For the 1860 presidential campaign, Republicans had enlisted the singing power of the most popular group in America, the Hutchesons, a New Hampshire farming family. Their songs, wrote Walt Whitman, were fresh, simple, beautiful, and free of any spirit of European imitation. Their untrained vocals were naturally eloquent, melodious, and devoid of affectation or stage grimace. They sang of common American experience and ordinary lives. When the Hutchesons were just getting started in Lynn, Massachusetts in 1840, they met a tall, newly self-emancipated young black man with the gift of silver-tongued speech. His name was Frederick Douglass. Douglass was a major influence on the Hutchesons' uncompromising commitment to social justice causes, and they developed a lifelong friendship. Lincoln loved the Hutchesons' music. He also loved blackface minstrelsy. The Hutchesons were freedom singers, and they used Republican rallies to sing for immediate emancipation, women's rights, prison reform, and temperance. The Hutchesons transformed blackface minstrel songs into abolitionist songs. For example, the racist, denigrating Old Dan Tucker became Get Off the Track, a demand that everyone interfering with black freedom get out of the way. The exegesis of war, the need for black troops, the valor of those troops, and Lincoln's personal contact with African-American activists strained his anti-abolitionist philosophy, his African colonization perspective, and his white supremacy. These included meeting with Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, and black leaders from the South. Indeed, Lincoln's administration represented the first time black Americans had ever entered the presence of a president other than as servants. As for servants, Lincoln had brought one with him from Illinois. We do not know much about William H. Johnson, not even his age, except that he was a grown man and Lincoln's valet. Lincoln characterized him as honest, faithful, sober, industrious, and handy. "I have confidence in his integrity," Lincoln said. A newspaper man had commented on Johnson's attentiveness to Lincoln in 1861 when they traveled to Washington together from Springfield. "Johnson was the most useful member of Lincoln's party," the reporter said. Johnson had a difficult time in Washington because the light-skinned black staff treated the dark-skinned man badly. Secretary of Treasury Salmon P. Chase found a place for Johnson at Lincoln's suggestion in the Treasury Department, and Johnson continued as Lincoln's personal valet, shaving him, serving as messenger, friend, and sometimes as bodyguard. In 1861 and 1862, Lincoln referred to Johnson in his writing as "my colored boy," not "the black man." By the time Lincoln issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in September of 1862, he spoke of Johnson as a worthy man. He took Johnson with him to meet his generals, especially the very racist George McClellan. And when Lincoln prepared to go to Gettysburg, he wrote in a curt note, "William goes with me." At least one writer believes that in preparing his Gettysburg address, Lincoln tried it out on William Johnson the night before he delivered it. En route back to Washington, Lincoln became ill. His face was shallow, eyes sunken, and he had a grievous headache. Johnson attended him, bathing his forehead with cold water. Back in Washington, a mild form of smallpox overtook Lincoln and his son, Tad, and they were ill for nearly 3 weeks. During that time, Johnson attended the president, and he contracted the disease himself. He got a more severe strain of it and had to be hospitalized. Now it was Lincoln's turn to be concerned for Johnson. Lincoln saw to Johnson's personal affairs, especially money owed to him by the Treasury Department. "I am acting according to Johnson's wishes," he said to a reporter as he counted greenbacks and put them in various envelopes and labeled them. Lincoln recovered. Johnson did not. In the cold January of 1864, Lincoln had William H. Johnson buried in the new National Cemetery at Arlington and personally paid for the burial. The headstone he chose identifies William Johnson with a single word, citizen. Instead of the 13th Amendment passed by Congress in 1861, in 1865, Lincoln ushered through another 13th Amendment that just barely slipped past the House of Representatives. It forever abolished slavery in the land. When the Civil War ended and Lincoln went to the former Capitol in Richmond, he asked William Lloyd Garrison to go with him. They marched together in the streets as throngs of African Americans cheered. And Lincoln's second inaugural address, a marked difference from the first, there were more African Americans present than whites. Thousands listened as Lincoln quoted Isaiah, the abolitionist's famous and most favorite Old Testament seer. Lincoln's most memorable passage sounded like Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass, or William Lloyd Garrison. Fondly do we hope, he wrote, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may soon pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword. As was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said today. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Was Lincoln an abolitionist? You be the judge.
Well, so many things were mentioned in Professor Washington's talk that are on your program today. So you will shortly hear a song by Asa Hutchinson, one of the abolitionist minstrels. And the only other person in this second part that I want to talk about is George F. Root, who in fact we don't know him as well as Stephen Foster, but he was a contemporary and wrote as many or more songs in similar style. So you'll hear one of his pieces as well. I should say, I introduced Professor Washington, maybe I should say who we are. Obviously one of us is Emily, and that's me. And this is Tyler Herman, who graduated this past year with a BA and a major in theater and
theater and dance and music.
Yes.
And Emily graduated this past spring.
I just finished my PhD from here in musicology, and we both live in DC, so we've been collaborating, rehearsing down there, and we're happy to be back.
And this is Brian Mastrell, and he's, we'll be hearing from him later, and he's a current student here.
Yeah. Also, before I forget, there is a reception afterwards, so feel free, please join us.
Has power to save him. lay him low, lay him low, under the clover or under the snow. What cares he? He cannot know. Said they, "Oh, people dear, poor old Uncle Sam is dead. Let us put him in his coffin and hammer down the lid." And to work they all went as the words they said. Hmm-ha. Said the people, "Is it so? Pray, what was it made him die? Though we never will believe you, you are so apt to lie." Was the nigger proclamation, they did cry. Hmm, ha, bum, 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 bum. But the people only laughed at the story that they told, for they knew his constitution and answered up so bold. Oh, you silly copperheads, you're badly sold. Hmm, ha. Uncle Sam, he then arose like a giant, hale and strong, with his people and his army, a glorious loyal throng. And the coppers sneak to where they all belong. Hmm, ha. Where
have gone to, it is now impossible to tell. But if they are not repenting, we all know very well that sometime or other we shall ring their knell. Hmm-ha.
So yes, our one last participant, aside from turning my pages, this is Brian Mastrell, who will read a poem that Lincoln wrote. Lincoln wrote a few poems in his life earlier. There's a set of three from 1844, and Brian will read one called "But Here's an Object." Do you have to stand?
But here's an object, more of dread than aught the grave contains, a human form with reason fled, while wretched life remains. Poor Matthew, once of genius bright, a fortune-favored child, now locked for aye in mental night, a haggard madman wild. Poor Matthew, I have ne'er forgot when first, with maddened will, yourself you maimed, your father fought, and mother strove to kill. When terror spread, and neighbors ran your dangerous strength to bind, and soon, a howling crazy man, your limbs were fast confined. How then you strove and shrieked aloud, your bones and sinews bared, and fiendish on the gazing crowd with burning eyeballs glared, and begged and swore and wept and prayed, with maniac laughter joined. How fearful were those signs displayed by pangs that killed the mind. And when at length, though drear and long, time soothed thy fiercer woes, how plaintively thy mournful song upon the still night rose. I've heard it oft, as if I dreamed, far distant, sweet and low, the funeral dirge, it ever seemed, of reason dead and gone. To drink its strains, I stole away, all stealthily and still, ere yet the rising god of day had streaked the eastern hill. Air held its breath, trees with the spell seemed sorrowing angels round, whose swelling tears in dewdrops fell upon the listening ground. But this is past, and naught remains that raised thee o'er the brute. Thy piercing shrieks and soothing strains are like forever mute. Now fare thee well, more thou the cause than subject now of woe. All mental pangs by time's kind laws hast lost the power to know. O death, thou awe-inspiring prince that keepest the world in fear, why dost thou tear more blessed ones hence and leave him lingering here?
A few notes about this last piece. As I mentioned, it was written by a friend of mine, Joseph Gregorio. He's a composer living in San Francisco. He wrote this piece for the Ives Quartet, which is a string quartet. They commissioned him, and it was premiered by them and baritone. And he then arranged it for us for piano and voice. It was a collaboration between him and his sister, Julie Gregorio. She was responsible for compiling the text. The whole of the piece is seven movements, so you'll be hearing movements 1, 3, and 7, which were Joe's choice, so those are his favorites among the seven. Julie Gregorio was responsible for putting the text together, and she, in some cases, wrote the text for the seventh movement. She wrote that longer poem. For the first and third, she adapted some texts. We heard about Frederick Douglass and Professor Washington's address. He gave a speech in 1876 about Lincoln, and Julie culled some lines from that and adapted it for the third movement that you'll hear. And the first movement is a fable, which you can tell from your text, that Abraham Lincoln copied when he was 13. It was one of his favorite fables. And Julie Gugurayo added the short introduction and then the moral at the end. And that's it.
These are the words copied by the pen of Abraham Lincoln, aged 13 years, son of Thomas Lincoln of Perry County, Indiana. As it is with people, so it is with nations. In union, there is strength. A kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. Cannot stand. world waited, would Abraham Lincoln keep his word? We waited and listened as for a bolt from the sky. We watched by the stars' dim light for the dawn of a new day. Shame. carried at great speed on a singular vessel of unfathomable desire toward a distant, indefinite shore. And from this vessel I seem to rise, and beyond the vastness of the sea, I beheld a land of deep forests and wide fertile valleys and trout silver rivers with water wheels flashing and red dust roads and high mountain passes and farms picked out in patchwork green and brown and the full blush of summer was blown bright on the land. I saw shining cities on the coasts and on the plains, broad avenues of white light and golden light, and children laughing amid the fountains. I saw men and women clear-eyed and unbound, speaking together in voices joyous and grave, walking freely in the squares, in the first cool blue of dusk. I saw black-skinned men and white, and every shade in all the richness of the earth. And there was room enough for all. I saw industry and ingenuity prosperity, and there, in the fading light, I saw. From the fullness of their hearts. Peace.